You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, dictionaries change from year to year. They're living documents. Merriam-Webster recently released their new batch of 370 words and definitions that it says have cemented themselves in popular usage to the point that they're worthy of being added to their dictionary. How does that process actually work? Who makes the call? For some words, does getting printed in the dictionary make them less cool somehow? We're going to get some answers and talk about some of these quote-unquote new words, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you look forward to when these new words come out? An interesting point of curiosity for you. Have you seen some of the latest on the list? Is there a word that's new to you, dictionary or not, that you've come across in slang or technology or food? Hot or not? Do you like the word or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And is there a word that you use maybe in your family or your workplace that's maybe unique to you and your local circle, but it serves a purpose? Tell us about it. 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett are co-hosts and co-producers of the radio show A Way with Words. You can hear them every Sunday morning at 9 here on the Ideas Network. Martha's written books on word origins and has a background in ancient Greek and Latin. Martha, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, Rob.
And Grant is a lexicographer and linguist specializing in slang and new words. Grant, good to talk to you again.
Hello.
Martha, okay, the dictionaries, they do this every year, sometimes more often, these new words. I grew up, I think I thought the dictionary was the rule book, right? These are the words we have, mm-hmm. the English language. These are the ones you can use. That's not really how it works. It's kind of a reflection of a changing language, right?
Exactly. That's a great word, reflection, because the dictionary just reports what's out there. It's more like, we used to have phone books. I guess we don't really have them anymore, but it's more like the phone book than the social register, you know, telling you what you should and shouldn't use. It's a record of how we speak.
And Grant, you've done some work actually producing dictionaries. What can you tell us about the process of determining whether a word makes the cut?
Oh, I could talk for hours about it, but in brief,
he does.
The brief version of it is it's a very thoughtful process. It's a lot of very bright people spending a huge amount of time, like more time than you can possibly imagine, reading and discussing and gathering data and really thinking about what the public would want to look up. And so they read a wide variety of subject matter. They record all the new uses and all the new words that they find. They put them in databases. Sometimes they record them in physical files. For example, Merriam-Webster has a physical file card catalog of more than 15 million cards that you can see if you visit their campus. And then when it comes time to update the dictionary, they go through and say, well, where are we? What's happening in the world right now? Or where in the alphabet are we? And they go through and they say, well, this is happening and this is happening. And in that way, these incredibly bright and thoughtful people, I mean, this is not something that they take lightly, put these words on the table and argue with a passion that you cannot imagine. I mean, and humor and grace and goodwill about what should be included. And so every word that is included in these new words list is the product of this a spirited process, a generous process. And trust me when I say that these people who put this together, it's a battle. It's a win and a loss every time a word does and doesn't make it.
We'll talk more about the process, but I want to get a taste of some of these new words in the dictionary. And Martha, yeah, let's get a taste of some of the food-related words they've added. Now, here's one. It's two words that were already there, pumpkin and spice, but they're now defining pumpkin spice as a definable phrase. Could you talk about that a little?
Well, yeah, they are indeed, right? For better or for worse. It seems like that just came out of nowhere a few years ago. And now, you know, it's something that you expect, especially in October. Another food word that caught my eye, that or food term that's recently been added to the dictionary, is oat milk. because that is what we call in language a retronym. It's a new term for an existing object or idea to distinguish it from a later development or invention. Like, for example, you know, we used to just talk about guitars, and now we talk about electric guitars and acoustic guitars. Or we talk about, you know, we used to talk just about radio, but now you have clock radios and car radios. So now also you have soy milk, almond milk, oat milk. And another retronym that was recently added that's not exactly food related, but it's meat space. You know this one, right?
Meat space is, as opposed to like being on a virtual meeting, right? We're in a place particular, right? Do I have that roughly right?
Yeah, meat space is the real physical world.
Okay.
It's the world of flesh and blood, as opposed to cyberspace. And meat space has been around since the early 1990s or so. So yeah,
oh, yeah.
Right, we might say, you know, let's get together with Grant in meat space. So we're not online. We're actually in a coffee shop.
Right. I feel
not
like that was in
Rocky Balboa in a butcher's.
Right. Well, that could be a meat space in a meat space, definitely.
Yeah, it could be.
Now that's, I feel like that was around an early cyberpunk writing, right? And so, Grant, what's with the time lag there? A phrase that's been around for a long time could take a long time to end up rising to a dictionary's attention.
Yeah, that's what I was saying about dictionary editors and lexicographers being very careful. They don't really jump the gun. Sometimes they're accused of putting these fly-by-night words in there, but the best lexicographers don't do that. They wait. A word has to prove itself. It has to show up for a long period of time across a wide variety of media used across a large spectrum of society, and it really needs to... It really has to have legs, as they say. That's one of my favorite expressions. It has to really show itself. I look at something, speaking of retronyms, something like dumb phone. How long have we been saying smartphone? Well, dumb phone is a retronym of smartphone. It's a phone that is modern but doesn't have any of the smartphone features, and that has been around forever. Even a term like shrinkflation has been around for a while, but it had to prove itself. And you know, it wasn't included just because it's become more commonly known in recent years, because it's not new. Even janky, which is on this year's Merriam-Webster list, dates to the 1960s. Janky meaning trashy or broken or badly made. So it really has got to show endurance, longevity.
We're talking to Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett from A Way with Words, looking at a batch of new words that entered, in this case, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, but also how words start and enter a language. And you could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Clem is with us in Portage. Clem, hi.
Well, good afternoon. How you doing?
Good. What do you got for us, Clem?
Well, I got an e-nuke word for you. It's a very, especially e-nuke word, which means unique. But since everybody's modifying the word unique, I figured I would make up a new word to mean absolutely, solitarily unique, which is, of course, the meaning of the word.
Clem, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Unique, I think people talk about it being watered down, like it could be, you know, comparatively unique. It's not one of a kind, but close. Now, Clem's trying to coin something. Martha, can we make Inuk a thing?
Like
Fetch. It worked for Fetch, right? Can
That's
we make
a
Inuk?
Cozy place to read your ebook, isn't it? An Inuk?
Clem makes a good point that a lot of people use the term unique and add the very to it, which sort of changes the meaning a little bit, but that's pretty much entrenched in the language now. You know, I mean, sticklers will say if something's unique, it's the only thing like it in the universe. Or the metaverse, or the multiverse. I think maybe you would need one of those compound German words with lots of syllables. I think he was starting down that path. Solitary, absolutely unique.
Definitely. Clem, thanks for that call. Now, he's trying to coin, I think, a slang term, Grant. And I understand you are I seem to recall you're a big fan of slang terms entering the language. You mentioned janky as one of those. Anything else on the new list hitting you from the world of slang?
Well, you know, I'm going to call her out, but your producer, Sarah, said that she uses yeet, even though she's 29, and I hardly endorse
She's not
yeet.
Lying.
And Yeet's another one of those. It's older than you think. It's from at least as early as 2007 as an interjection, expressing surprise or approval or enthusiasm. And then it was turned into a verb because you would shout it as a interjection when you would throw something. So now it means to throw. And it's kind of the opposite of yoink, which means to take something suddenly. And it's weird because we all thought, I say we, meaning people who studied the changing lexicon, we all thought it was just going to burn out as fast as something like bling bling did. But it really looks like it might stick around for a while because it's still lurking. Martha and I just did a school visit in Huntsville, Alabama, and it turned up on a bunch of the cards of slang submitted by the high school kids there. So they're not done with it yet.
We're talking to Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett, co-hosts and co-producers of the radio show A Way with Words. Check it out on the Ideas Network Sunday mornings at 9. And we're talking about new words being added to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary and other dictionaries. We're also talking about how words make it into language in the first place, too. They get yeeted into the language. Is that Sarah? Thumbs up? No. Yeah, okay, great. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered a word that was new to you recently? Friend or foe, did you like it or not? Do you have questions for our guests about words and how they come to be in general? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret, here now with co-hosts of A Way with Words, Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett, talking about word origins and new dictionary words after Merriam-Webster announced the latest edition, 370 new words and definitions. Go back to your many calls at 800-642-1234. Valerie is with us now in Eau Claire. Valerie, hi.
Hello. The word I'm looking at is scrum. So my daughters both played rugby, and the scrum is when the group works together to move the ball. Well, one of the daughters is now working for a company, and she is a scrum manager for her group of coworkers.
And I'm guessing, Valerie, that doesn't mean that her business has a rugby team. It means something completely different, right?
It means completely different that she is, I mean, it's still a group working towards a common goal, but that's the first time I had ever heard anything in business as being a scrum manager.
Interesting. Valerie, thanks a lot for that call. Martha, as I think about it, I guess this probably happens, you know, we might huddle up at a team meeting at a workplace. Sometimes phrases go from the sports world to business and elsewhere.
Yeah. How interesting. I mean, how interesting. Think about baseball, for example. There's so many terms that have been adopted into the business world and elsewhere from baseball, you know, hitting a home run, for example, or touching all the bases. Scrum manager is a new one on me. Have you heard it, Grant?
Yeah, it's part of a project management methodology that it really started to take hold in Silicon Valley and then those sorts of businesses. And involves certain kinds of principles that I won't get into here about how to manage a process of developing a project so that all parts of the project are respected and all people in the process get their due. So that it's not a top-down process, it's a through-and-through process. I mean, I know that I've shorted it and scrum managers are now shouting at the radio, but it's an established project management philosophy, which you can buy books on and get training in.
As Valerie was talking, I was looking up Scrum Master, and I got to say the descriptions I'm seeing are using a language that identify as English, but very much corporate speak.
You know, Six Sigma and all that stuff from back in the day, it's reminiscent of that. It's you sometimes wonder if it isn't selling shovels to the gold miners. It's more about getting paid to teach the training than it is about actually getting the training that go well, if that makes sense.
Excellent. All right. Thanks for that call, Valerie, at 800-642-1234. Kevin joins us next in Viroqua. Kevin, hi.
Hi.
What words do you have for us today, Kevin?
Well, one from each side of the family. My mother's side used a term, and it was slaunch-wise. I don't know how she spelled it. But it referred to slaunch-wise was anything that's kind of cockeyed, especially if Dad was lying diagonally on the bed. He was sleeping slaunch-wise. And the other is febble, F-E-B-B-L-E, referring to small fluttering white moths that annoy people inside the house. That's from my wife's side of the family, the febble.
Unique to your family, Kevin. Martha, I dimly remember, did we talk one time about sort of those unique words that we have in our own little communities, whether it's a family or group of friends or something like that? Is that something that a lot of people do?
Oh, of course. Yes, I think every family has its own language and own code and words that are invented by children, for example, and you just keep saying them because they're just so cute and they're little souvenirs of their childhood once they get older. Febbles is the word? Bird or
febble? Febble was the little fluttering insect that we don't know the name of for real, I guess. Yeah.
Boy, I don't know that. It reminds me of greebles, which are those little things, those little balls of lint in your pockets.
Wait, there's actually a word for the little balls of lint in my pocket?
I believe there is.
Greebles? Oh, that's also the name of what cats seem to be chasing when they go crazy in the house and you can't see what the invisible spirits are that they're looking at and nobody else can see. Greebles.
Wait, oh, those are greebles, not febbles. And then the other word, slaunchwise, has been around for a while. That's
oh, really?
A dialectal term that has to do with something being slanted or off. A lot of people use the word catawampus or antigoglin or psigoglin, but they're all words for something that's kind of askew, you know, like a picture frame that's not quite hung correctly.
Yeah, it's got about 200 years history in the United States, slaunchwise.
So, Kevin, that one, I think it was your mother-in-law, isn't making it up. She's actually got a way with words. We're talking to Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett from A Way with Words. Check them out on the Ideas Network Sunday mornings at 9. We're talking about new words entering the language, entering the dictionaries, and you are sharing yours at 800-642-1234. Steve joins us next in Hayward. Hi, Steve. Are you there, Steve?
Hello.
Yeah, go for it, Steve. Yes. What's your word for us today?
My word is E-E-W-E. It's spelled I-I-W-I-I, and it stands for it is what it is.
Oh, okay. And is this is something that you say to other people?
Yeah, as far as I know, I made it up. And,
okay.
Because we were in a circumstance where we needed to... Someone said this so often that we shortened it to ee-wee-ee. And so it was a little snarky, but I was just curious. I listened to your program on Sundays and love it. And just curious if you've heard of this before, or if in fact I did make it up.
Okay. So first of all, that particular word acronym, I guess, Martha and Grant, and also is this a pretty common way that words happen, that they're, in the case of ee-wee-ee, abbreviations like that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the one that comes to mind for me is WYSIWYG, you know, what you see is what you get, or Wombat, which is a waste of money, brains, and time. I mean, I think some of those, it's just easier to say the abbreviated version, and I'm certainly going to adopt EEWEE. Makes perfect sense to me.
A quick Google turns up a few places where people have used it, and it actually looks like somebody has trademarked it, but
uh-oh.
Don't let that stop you.
Yeah, just keep it on the down low, Steve. Don't call into public radio shows and admit that you're using that trademark phrase, whatever you do. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. How about Laura next in Madison? Laura, hi.
Hi. I was calling about the word biweekly or bimonthly, and it always bothered me. What gives? I mean, it's so confusing. And the same thing with winterized. Sometimes it means close down for the winter. Other times it means adapt for the winter. So why is that?
Well, I'm guessing Laura is the only person who's ever had a problem with bimonthly and biweekly, right?
Our advice is usually, Laura, just give it up. Don't bother. Don't
twice
use the
a
word.
Week.
Just put it in a frame and put it on the wall and admire it and just say every other week or every 2 weeks and move on or twice a week. Just avoid all confusion that way.
All right. Okay. If she really wants to. Martha, do you have a rule or no?
No, there's no rule. Except you're just going to have to explain it every time. That's the problem with it. You're going to have to say bi-weekly. And by that, I mean.
Right. Yeah. There's really no way around it except a word around it.
All right.
You're always going to have somebody show up at the wrong time.
Excellent. Thanks for that call, Laura. Peter joins us now in Milwaukee. Peter, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Hey, I have a couple of comments and then a quick question. So I think I actually have a couple of new words for you to consider, but I'll give you those at the end to keep you.
We just got a little bit of time. Hit us with your main thing, Peter.
The main thing I wanted to talk about is the diminution of the language related to what people think are new words but are really incorrect usages, and also adding words that don't make any sense at all. So your guest mentioned the concept of oat milk. Well, I'm from Wisconsin. I come from a dairy family, and I know for a fact that milk is the food product created by the mammalian class of animals and not some juice of a fruit or vegetable, okay?
Peter, I got you. We're just about out of time. Language is, you mentioned oat milk was added to the dictionary here. Language can be contentious. Who wants to bring us out with that?
I mean more than one thing. Just for example, that meat, the word M-E-A-T, those same cows give us meat. Meat used to mean all food, not just their muscle matter. So, and what about the if you read the Bible, milk is used to mean more than milk of the cow. Huh. So there's lots of things that milk can mean.
All right. And Martha, 30 seconds, a trend you're watching for in new word creation.
Oh, boy, a trend I'm watching for. It's not exactly new word creation, but somebody told me the other day that they liked my drip. And I said, what?
Oh, yeah, that was a high compliment, Martha. You must have been really styling.
Well, I figured out eventually that it was a compliment because it's a word, of course, that we've known historically to mean you know, drops falling. But if you like somebody's drip, you like how they're styling. Yeah, how they're dressing. It's like they're dripping with diamonds. But that's something I heard from a 20-something, and I was very happy once I actually learned the meaning of that word.
No one has ever said that to me. Thanks to our guests today, Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett, co-hosts of Away With Words. Check them out Sunday mornings at 9 here on the Ideas Network. Keep sharing your favorite words. Email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Ferret. Now, you might sign kids up to play sports for a lot of reasons. They get to exercise, learn about teamwork, maybe make some friends along the way. But our next guest says youth sports have changed a lot over the last few decades. She's been an athlete, the parent of an athlete, and a coach herself. She says there's less of an emphasis now on fun, a bigger focus on competitiveness, driven in part by the multi-billion-dollar youth sports industry and by college sports. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had an experience in youth sports lately? Has it become too expensive? Has your family been priced out of some sports completely? Are we grown-ups putting too much pressure on kids to compete at a high level instead of having fun and getting exercise? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Linda Flanagan is a freelance journalist, researcher, and former track and cross-country coach. Her new book is Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. Linda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
In your book, Linda, you highlight a lot of the problems with youth sports. We'll get to those, but in a lot of ways, you really love athletics, at least their potential. Before we get to the negatives, what would a good, positive youth sports culture look like?
Oh, it would look reasonable. It would involve a supportive coach who looked out for all the kids on the team, was gearing the practices up so that they suited the kids' developmental level. They would be moderate. They would be age appropriate. So you wouldn't have a five-year-old having practices 4 days a week and two games on the weekend. There would be opportunities for growth, development, to learn about teamwork. The coach would, of older kids, would help them understand the application of what they've learned on the team to the rest of their life. So they would learn beyond, the X's and O's of a game. I mean, there's all kinds of wonderful things you can learn from sports. And I'm a big believer in what they can do for you. And I've benefited so much myself. It's just that they've changed so much that we've lost a lot of that.
Let's get into some of those changes. One of them I mentioned is the money. Could you talk about just how much that has exploded as an industry?
Yes, it's really kind of shocking that it is a $19 billion industry. That's B, billion. And to put it in context, the NFL is a $15 billion industry. And it has just taken off. Since 2010, it has grown 90%. And, you know, the long short of it is there's a lot of people profiting off your family.
Now, a big part of the problem is, and I'll admit, I'm a sports parent myself. I wasn't the worst one out there, but there are things I wish I had done differently. What is driving parents to define ourselves in a way by what our kids do out there on some sort of athletic field?
You know, it's such an interesting question, and it really does go beyond athletics. But, sports are so popular. They're the most popular extracurricular activity that's where we see it the most. But there's been a change in the adult perspective on childhood and a new understanding of what we parents think we owe our kids. As the great journalist Jennifer Senior put it, she said, "Children have moved from our employees to our bosses." And I think that really, that hits home and really resonates, because it can sometimes feel like our kids' schedules and lives are the deciding factor of what the family does. And this is more so than in the past, that parents derive status from their offspring. And I explain more about how that happened in my book.
Are kids still having fun out there, or have we grownups in a lot of ways sucked the fun out of the games?
Well, I mean, of course, that's one of the giant problems is that, everyone says this, everyone I spoke to, and I talked to so many people about youth sports and what's changed and where they're headed. And, one of the common themes is that they're just not fun anymore. They're serious. You see third graders with their uniforms and they're tucked in, and there's an official walking by to make sure they have regulation socks on. And it's just become more about adults and, commercialism than it is about, the kids' enjoyment. And, that's a real loss, because some of the kids will quit and never really develop athletically.
Talking to Linda Flanagan about her new book, Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. You can join in with your experiences as a youth athlete now or in the past, as a parent thereof, a coach, a ref. What are you seeing? What do you wish could change about the game, whichever game it is? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Linda, before we go to our callers, I want to go to another piece of the puzzle that looms over everything: college sports. How have changes in college sports driven what we're seeing at younger and younger ages?
Well, it's not just changes at sports in colleges and universities. It's also about just broader changes at those institutions overall. I mean, for one, they cost a fortune. Everyone knows that tuition costs are staggeringly high. It's $44,000 a year is the average cost for a national private university. It's $12,000 for a state university. I mean, these are just giant expenses. And on top of that, the perception is that it is much harder for kids to get in. And there's a lot of data to back that up. So there's a lot of insecurity about where kids are going to go. And parents worry that they're not going to be able to go to the same level school that perhaps they went to. And then you have sports. And they seem to offer not exactly a shortcut, but another way in. Because sports, they generally offer more athletes in who have somewhat lower academic standards. There's a streamlined recruiting process. And of course, there's $3.6 billion in scholarship money, athletic scholarship money that, can be dangled before parents to make it seem like, well, this might be the way in.
And that gets to this incentive structure, I think, for parents. Well, if I hold off on my kids starting whatever sport it is until fourth grade, and all those other kids were already in since kindergarten, are they behind? Are they going to be able to keep up? Are they going to compete for that college admission or maybe that D1 scholarship, however much of a long shot that might be? It's an arms race, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, I really wish someone, and maybe I'll do this one day, would figure out what the investment would be if parents took the money they put into their kids' sports and put it into, you know, an index fund or something, and over 10 years, and saw what that ballooned to versus what they're going to get out on the other end of it. Because, you know, 2% of high school athletes, first of all, only 6% of high school athletes even play sports in college. Only 2% get any kind of scholarship money at all. You know, if that's why you're doing it, it's really playing the lottery.
You're worried about the kids mainly, but you also talk about the stress that the travel, the time, the money puts on parents and families. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, I really think it's kind of an underappreciated problem, how much have sports have kind of taken over family life. It's like it's kind of an alternate universe for those families that are involved in it, where, you know, if it's, there's a two-parent household, there's a lot of dividing and conquering. One parent drives the son to Virginia for a lacrosse tournament, and the mother drives the daughter to Connecticut for a soccer tournament. There's just a lot of disruption in families, and also for siblings who, you know, somehow are either dragged along or expected to follow along. It's not all good by any means. And it's hard. It can be hard on marriages. We have little data on that. But if you ask around, you can see that there's no way it can't have an effect on marriages and on family finances.
We're talking to Linda Flanagan, journalist, former track and cross-country coach, with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you one of these families that's gone all in on youth sports? Did it creep up on you? Did you find yourself spending more money, more time on sports? If you are a youth yourself, if you're into sports, do you feel a lot of pressure, or are you able to have fun doing it? And how about the atmosphere at kids' games? A lot of people yelling at the referees, arguing with the coaches, overcoaching from the parents' sidelines. What are you seeing? How can we fix it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Linda Flanagan about her new book. It's Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your own experience with youth sports as a parent, a family member, a coach, a referee, maybe a young person yourself. Do you see problems? What still makes it worthwhile if you think it is? Are there changes you'd like to see, whether it's behavior of parents on the sidelines or bigger changes in the whole system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Kathy in Deerfield, who says her kids are grown. They raised them back in the 80s now. And back then, when they were in club sports, Kathy says they were upset. The coaches at club sports are upset that the kids took the summer off and that the kids played multiple sports. So this has been around for a while. Linda, this is a story you've run into a lot. Why are you playing another sport? Yes. Why are you taking time off of our sport and things like that?
Yes, yes. And that's only gotten worse. I mean, it's even just over the last decade, you know, clubs and private teams are expecting athletes to not only play during the summer, but, you know, by the way, play what would traditionally be considered a spring sport in the fall and the winter too. There's just more heaped on kids and their families, more expectations. And it's very hard to resist. So, you know, kudos to the mom who did, because it's hard to resist that kind of pressure.
Thanks for that call, Kathy. Another consequence we haven't gotten into that you're right about, Linda, is risk of injuries, often, especially if we overdo just one sport. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, I mean, the medical people I spoke to, the sports doctors, the common word they used was epidemic. They said there's an epidemic of overuse injuries. And I should add, overuse injuries are completely preventable. They're just from using, you know, various parts of the body too much for too long. It's repetitive use. There's an epidemic of overuse injuries. And in Tommy John surgery, we all know about that. I spoke to an orthopedic doctor who said he's been performing this surgery on 12-year-olds. You know, there are more stress fractures, growth plate injuries, injuries to knees and tendons. You know, for young women, there's the female athlete triad. These sort of what you could consider chronic or kind of debilitating injuries, like overuse injuries. And then there are also the more catastrophic ones like ACL tears, which have become an enormous problem. They're devastating injuries that to the knee, and you know, it puts kids on the sidelines for, you know, 6 to 12 months and gets them out of their sport. And what I found, I was shocked to discover that doctors are saying that half of the people who tear their ACLs will have arthritis in that knee in 10 years. You know, and in my community, you know, it seems like every other week I'm hearing about usually a girl, often a middle school girl, another girl on the team, on the lacrosse team, tore her ACL. Well, if that girl is 12 or 13, she could be hobbling around, you know, at 23 with arthritis. So it's not just a short term. It's not just, you know, oh, this season you're on the sidelines. It can have, you know, longer term consequences down the road.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jesse is with us in Madison. Jesse, hello.
Hello. You know, on this season, and you're on the sidelines, it can have, you know, longer term consequences.
Sorry, Jesse, your connection is not great. Jesse told our call screener he's been coaching for 17 years, seen a transition of kids' sports into almost semi-pro. Parents are praying their kids go pro, and parents give them lots of instructions on where and when to play their kid. Do you hear this a lot from coaches, Linda?
Oh, God. I mean, that's so typical. It's just, you know, they're like the parents have become like agents on the sidelines to some extent. And it is just, you know, very counter to what youth sports are supposed to be for, which is children's development and appreciation for sports. You know, a vanishingly small number of kids are going to go on to play professionally. It's, you know, this idea that somehow if the parent yells the right instruction on the sideline is going to make the difference is simply wrong, and it is not helpful to either the child or the coach.
Thanks for calling in, Jesse. Sorry we lost you there at 800-642-1234. Talk to Linda Flanagan about youth sports. Her book is called Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. Still time for you to share your story, your question, maybe your solutions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Linda, let's talk about some of your solutions. One big one that I guess you even suggest we won't hold our breath on is getting rid of college sports as we know it, and going to club and intramural sports. As a thought exercise, what would that look like? How would it help?
Well, I mean, just imagine for a minute if college sports were run the way high school sports are, so that kids, you know, if they wanted to join the football team or the tennis team, they tried out at the start of the season. They arrive on campus and then they decide they're going to try out for the team and the coach picks them. I mean, it's so alien to the way it's done now with this giant and expensive recruiting process. But if you had tryouts, say, you still had intramural sports and you had club sports, so kids could still play, the incentive structure for the club teams and the privatization of youth sports and commercialization of it would evaporate, because much of what drives some of the nonsense is this hope that kids will be recruited and perhaps they'll get into a better college. That would eliminate the problem. But again, I'm not holding my breath. It's not going to happen.
Let's bring on another caller now. Reed is with us in Whitewater. Reed, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about?
I was curious your thoughts about the mental health issues that also come with very competitive sports at a young age. When I was playing soccer competitively, it was just destructive to have coaches and parents just rail on other kids slash yell at kids who are 12, 11, 10, and just tell you, you know, you suck. You have to go join another team. You're kicked off the team, whatnot.
Reed, thanks for the call. Linda, again, probably more common than we'd like, the mental health impact.
I mean, it's just so terrible. And I it still shocks me that we kind of allow this, that, you know, we have this carve out for atrocious behavior in sports that we just would never dream of allowing in the classroom or the workplace. And I think, you know, we are seeing more attention being paid to this at the college level because we've had some, you know, some terrible suicides over the past year or so. And it's called attention to the fact that, you know, it's certainly at the college level, there's so enormous amount of pressure and stress and sleep deprivation that goes on. And it's just that is kind of trickling down, certainly to high school, too, where kids feel a ton of pressure. And, you know, I want to add, some kids can take it. Some kids love it. They thrive on that competitiveness. But, you know, a good portion, it's too much for them.
Thanks for that call, Reed. You've got a lot of solutions in the book, Linda, for parents and families. I want to look at the community level for a moment. You highlight some communities that have rethought how they approach youth sports. What are some of the best lessons we could do at that level?
Well, I think if you look at, say, the high school, there's a high school I profile, Tuscarora High School in Maryland, that has shifted the way it views sports in that it's not just all after school. They do intramural and they have intramural classes, sports during the day. They offer a lot of club programs. They offer programs for kids with disabilities, physical and intellectual. And their purpose is inclusion. And, you know, it is just it's a healthier environment. 53% of the kids at that school participate in sports. And, you know, there are ways to kind of shift it from this ultra serious win at all costs, you know, short term success that is the kind of defines youth sports now.
And that raises a really big point here, Linda. One consequence of all of this doesn't have anything to do with the kids who are in these high pressure sports environments. We have lots and lots of kids who don't get much exercise, who aren't involved in these group activities. How do we make sure we get them out there, too?
I know. Well, that's the, you know, one of the terrible consequences of this commercialization is that, you know, so many kids are just edged out of sports. It's like entirely participation in sports is essentially class-based. And, you know, some people in leadership positions are striving to correct that. I profile in the book a woman named Monica Wallace, who's a council member in New York State, and she lobbied when Governor Cuomo introduced legislation to allow for mobile sports betting. She lobbied to include a provision that would carve out $5 million every year to go to low-income areas where children are denied or don't have access to sports. So that there are, you know, around the edges, there are efforts being made to where among, you know, leaders and people who have some authority who can address this to repair it on the margins. And, you know, that's just one state. I believe other states have taken similar steps.
Linda, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Linda Flanagan. She's a freelance journalist, researcher, and former track and cross-country coach. She was with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. There's still time for you to share your experiences, negative or positive. If you were involved in a team, a community that you think got things right, love to hear about that. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Again, look for the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email us, ideas@WPR.org, to share your experiences in youth sports, for better or for worse. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.